Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, Joyce. Get up for Joyce.
My name is Joyce, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, I have to say, this is probably my favorite time of day when I get to stand up or sit down and be in a room of alcoholics and admit that I'm an alcoholic and know that there's a solution, and that because of that solution and all of you in this room that show me it's possible, I don't ever have to drink again. That's incredible. I want to welcome all the people that are new and taking chips. What an awesome, awesome experience to come up here and show that sobriety works for any amount of time. You know, being an alcoholic, I woke up this morning, and at that time when I first wake up is when I take a moment and remember exactly what it was like 5 years ago every morning when I woke up. It says in the big book that there'll come a day when the alcoholic will forget with sufficient force the exact horrors of their last drink, and they'll drink again. And nothing that I want to do more than to not drink. So I spend a moment thinking about that, and you know, I can recall without even a moment of hesitation waking up and the desperation, the loneliness, the despair, the incomprehensible demoralization that I felt every morning, because every morning I would swear off that I was never going to drink again, and by that night I was drinking again. And I take a moment and recall that because I don't want to forget it. And you know, the amazing thing is it like pushes me out of bed. I get on my knees, I ask God for help, and I work the first three steps of this program, and I recognize that I can't, He can, and I'll let Him. And I get ready for work, and as I go into my bathroom, which is my first stop in the morning, I see this sign over my mirror, and it says, "I'm not lucky, I'm blessed." And that kind of sets my tone for the day, because being lucky implies that I had something to do with it, and I had nothing to do with it. When I tried, all I did was got drunk. But by the grace of God and the blessings that I received by asking for help in this program, I don't have to drink. Today I've had like this miraculous day. I got to work on time. I was actually a really good employee and got work done. I got to go home after work and have dinner with my family. My daughter showed up and brought my granddaughter, and I'm still like so jazzed because the first word she said where you could understand it when it came to the grandparents was grandma, and I'm the grandma. The other one's Grammy and the other one's Glamma, but she got out grandma. And I make sure that they all remember that. So, you know, that's a pretty awesome day for me today. And, you know, I remember that because all I have is today. And this is the only moment in time I have. And tonight I get to be here in the midst of such great company. And, you know, God willing, I'll get to do the same thing again tomorrow, because so far it's worked for the last 5 years. And that's a blessing to me. When I got here, I woke up on a morning in May in 2013, and I decided that I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I knew I was a drunk. I needed to go to a meeting. I didn't know anything about AA, but I knew that's where you went to get sober. I'd read through the list, and the most productive time for me to go was at noon, because I was very, very important. I'm sure you all recognize that, you know, because I had a job and I had important things to do. And it worked into my schedule to go at noon, and I thought that I should go to Bridge Street Drunks, because I was a drunk after all, so that's where I belonged. And I go off to work, and you know, of course I followed the same principle I always did, because I was drinking and driving quite a bit, and in order to combat that, I would buy my alcohol before I went to work, drink a little bit, because we all know that alcohol will explode when you put it in the freezer, and I didn't want that to happen, you know, and then I would go to work. So I did do that day, but you know, I was gonna like not drink after that. And you know, the most amazing thing that we hear all the time, and they repeat it at almost every meeting, is the fact that alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. I couldn't understand why people read that at every meeting, and you know, today I understand it's because you forget. I forget all the time. And it is, you know, I woke up at 7 o'clock in the morning, I knew I was an alcoholic, I knew I needed to go to the meeting, I was going to go at noon, I was bound and determined. By noon that day, I drove over to the meeting, and as I'm driving over there, I'm like, oh, you know what, I'm over on the north side of Visalia. You know, my dad was a cop in Visalia, and we weren't supposed to go on the north side. And, you know, maybe I shouldn't be over here. And, you know, I'm like, well, you know, I am like 47, and dad lives in another state, so I probably can do it. And I drove up to Bridge Street Drunks, and it was at this little house, and there was a table outside, and there was all these little old men sitting out there smoking. And I was like, well, I don't know anything anything about AA, but I think you have to share, and they would never understand me. So I left. My next best thinking was that I would go to the Alano Club, because it had a noon meeting, and I drove up out there, and people were walking in with baggy pants and chains hanging and tattoos, and I was like, oh, you know what, I probably shouldn't go in there. I worked for a police department, they'll probably know me, which is totally stupid, because I was a police dispatcher. Nobody saw me. They only heard my voice, but I was sure they would know me. So I left, but I was bound and determined I was going to go to a meeting, and so I looked on that schedule again, and lo and behold, there was a women's meeting that night at the Trinity Church. And that made total sense to me, because I grew up in Christian Reformed Church. That's a spin-off of Christian Reformed Church, so I could be at home. So I go to that meeting, and the most incredible thing happened. I walked in there, and there was a big group of women, and they were all happy, and they were laughing, and they were sharing, and I couldn't understand what they were happy about, and I couldn't understand why they're sharing, and I couldn't understand how this AA thing could work, because all they did was talk in a circle, and that made no sense to me. And I did listen to their stories, and you know, I was so happy by the time I left there, because they had a place to go, because they were messed up, and I didn't even think I was an alcoholic anymore. So I went home, and you know, the one thing I took away from that meeting was that it's progress, not perfection. And I'll be damned, I had progress, not perfection, because I didn't drink until I got all the way home. So it was working. You know, I spent the next week being drunk most every night again, and I thought, well, you know what, I probably need to go back to that meeting again. So I went back to that meeting, and you know, they were still nice. Oh, I forgot to mention, a lady that had 20 years of sobriety bought me a big book that night, and they gave me a chip. I was like, wow, you know what, these people are like super cool. And so I went back and I listened again, and you know, it still didn't work again, because I still got drunk. And I was like, well, shoot, you know, this seems to be working for everybody else, but it's not working for me very well. So I went the third week, and they were talking about how they call other people, and I thought, oh, you know what, that's the problem. I didn't call anybody. So I was able to not drink for 3 whole days that week, and I thought, you know, I'm starting to feel a little shaky, so I'll call somebody on that list. I didn't call the lady with 20 years of sobriety that bought me the book. I called the one that had been sober for like 3 months and was struggling, because I was going to help her after all. You know, I'd been sober for 3 days. So I called her and we talked, and she told me what was going on with her, and I said, you know, I just don't understand why you would want to drink. I have been sober for 3 whole days. It is not that hard. And she said, you're just on a pink cloud and you're going to fall off. So I did. I just thought I might as well go ahead and do it. So, you know, my best thinking at that point was, you know, it's a little bit of time from that Tuesday meeting till the next Tuesday meeting, and the weekend seemed to be the worst. So I'll go to the Alano Club, and I will go at noon on a Friday, and then that should be able to get me through till Tuesday, and I'll be fine. So I drive up in my car thinking that, you know, I'm not any better than anybody else. I'm an alcoholic. I convinced myself, and I needed to be there, and, you know, that shit went right out the window when I walked in, because I was sure that everybody was looking at me, because I drove up in a car, and I had a job, and I had a purse that obviously had money in it, because I thought it was super important, and it didn't have any money because I drank it all away, but I had a really good illusion of that. So I walked in, and I sat down, and I'm holding my purse all scared to death, and they passed the basket around, and it got back up to the front, and the secretary of the meeting said, you know, there's a lot of people in this room, and we didn't get quite enough to cover the rent, so I'm going to send this basket around again, and you know, maybe the people of you that have a job would be willing to put in a couple extra dollars and help out. I was so pissed. I knew he was talking to me, and I was like, you know what, I can't believe that M or F is going to expect me to support this whole damn meeting. And I got up and flounced out, and you know, I'm so grateful for that moment in time, you know, that alcohol had taken me where it did, because I went on the worst drunk I'd ever been on in my life. I barely woke up until Sunday morning, stayed sober through Sunday. Well, I stayed dry through Sunday because I was going out of town. I made my son go with me into everywhere I went, so I didn't buy any alcohol. We made it home. Monday morning, I started out my normal routine, but I was running late, so I bought that pint of Jack Daniels, headed off to work, and by Soya. drank half of it between Tulare and Visalia, got to work at 7 o'clock in the morning, put it in the freezer, which wasn't unusual. We had alcohol because we used to have different clients that came in the house, so nobody, or into the office, so they wouldn't really notice. And besides that, it was in a brown paper bag, so nobody would have looked, you know. And I'm sitting there working, and my brain keeps telling me, you know, I really should probably just drink that, you know, because I'd hate for it to, like, get stale in the freezer, or, you know, what if this happened, or, you know, so my best thinking was just go finish it, and so I did. And it was 7:30 in the morning, and I was in a blackout drunk at work, and I stayed till about 10 o'clock. I don't remember a lot of it. The only reason I actually remember that I was in a blackout drunk at 7:30 in the morning is I was trying to fax the paper, and it took me 3 days to find it after I wasn't drinking. And I did find it, I did fax it, and I had faxed it at 7:30 in the morning. Went to leave, I was crying, I do remember crying, I don't remember why I was crying, ran into my boss in the parking lot, he's asking if I'm okay, and I'm like, you just don't understand my life, and he's like, do you need me to drive you home? I'm like, no, I'm fine. So I drive home, I'm guessing I drove down the 99 freeway because that's the way I always went, don't remember any of it except little bits and pieces, crawled into bed, about 4 hours later woke up, just clueless. I had no idea how this could have happened. I just didn't even know. Call my boss, scared to death that I had lost my job. My job at that point was the only thing that was making me believe I wasn't an alcoholic because I was able to hold a job, and now I might have lost that. And I did get a hold of that boss, and I started out, you know, my normal little liturgy. I don't know what happened. And he's like, I know what happened. You showed up to work drunk from last night. For the first time in my life, I didn't correct him and tell him I got drunk that morning, which was probably helpful. He said to me, he said, you know, I'm really tired of your crying and your belly aching. I need you. I need you at work. I need you to pull your head out of your ass. Tell me what you need right now, and I'll do whatever you need, and you need to come back to work. So I told him, I said, you know what, I'll be fine by morning. I'll see you in the morning. He said, all right, this is your one shot. I said, okay. The first thought that went through my mind was, I could drink rest of today, and I'll be fine tomorrow. And at that moment, I knew that I was insane. And at that moment, I did call the lady that had 20 years of sobriety, and she agreed to meet with me. We went out to dinner, and you know, I'm trying to like choke down this food, and I'm telling her my sad story, and she's listening, and she wasn't overly impressed at all, but I tried a little harder, and she still wasn't impressed. And she says, we're going to go to a meeting. So into a meeting, of all things, she took me to a meditation meeting where you have to like be quiet and meditate for 10 minutes. That was the longest 10 minutes of my whole entire life. But you know, something changed in that moment, and I started feeling the energy of the room. And, you know, the one thing I took away from that meeting I share often is I remember a lady saying that she really loved the part of the big book where it talks about people that wouldn't normally mix come together and they stay together. And at that moment in time, I wanted that, because the one thing that I seemed to be able to identify with everybody that spoke was the loneliness, and I didn't want to be alone. So we get back in the car afterward, and she tells me, okay, this was on a Monday. She says, Tuesday, we're going to go to the women's meeting, and Wednesday, I'm coming to your house, and we're going to start working on the steps. And I'm like, hey, that, you know, I have a job and stuff, too. And I said, you know, isn't that a little much? And that's like every night. And I said, what happened to Easy Does It? I remember you guys talking about that, too. And she says, no, this is what we're going to do. And she said, on top of that, she said, in 2 days, I want you to call Rayanne. It's her birthday, and I want you to tell her happy birthday. I'm like, I don't even know Rayanne. Why do you want me to call Rayanne? She says, you just need to call Rayanne, and you need to tell her happy birthday and quit thinking about yourself. And I said, okay. And I was hoping Rayanne didn't answer, but, you know, as this program goes, Rayanne answered. And what a blessing that was. And I came to start understanding how important it is when you need to call somebody because you need to talk to another alcoholic that can understand you, and somebody picks up, you know. And I'll always forever be grateful to Rayanne for picking up that moment. And so I started on my journey, and you know, these women, they were incredible. They had so many great things to offer. And you know, there were some ladies in the group that I didn't really care about too much, and then there were some that I was really drawn to. And you know, when I didn't understand some things that were going on and I needed help, I could call one of them. And you know, I remember asking this one lady, I said, you know, I'm having a really hard time after after work, you know, getting from work to home, because I would always buy alcohol then. And she says, well, maybe if you listen to a speaker tape, maybe that would help. And I said, oh, okay. So she brought me some speaker tapes, and one of them is a gentleman named Vern. Vern's from Kentucky. He's a psychiatrist and an alcoholic, so he had a real interesting mix. And I listened to his tape, and I could identify with a lot of it, but the one thing that I took away that gave me so much hope at that time was Vern said that if you're willing to do what we do and you're willing to follow the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, there will come a day when you will never walk alone. And I was like, wow, you know what? That's what I want. And, you know, I went through that first few months, and it was a little bit stressful because that sponsor, she was a pain in my butt. She had a lot of rules. She wanted me to go to a lot of meetings. She wanted me to do a lot of stuff. And she was forever reminding me how I was a liar. I lied about this. I lied about that. Every time I tried to tell her something, she'd tell me I'm lying. And I'm like, I'm trying to not lie. My daughter was getting married 3 months after I got sober, and I wanted so bad to be that mom that could be there and be supportive of their daughter, because, you know, I already had enough program to realize that I hadn't been there for her at all during the time when she was planning this wedding. So I wanted to be there, and I wanted it to be a happy moment and a joyous moment, and I was trying everything that I could. And my sponsor had told me in the very beginning, she said, you know, you got to stop listening to your mind and start listening to your heart. It'll be that little voice, and if you're quiet, you can hear it. And so, you know, when my daughter would call and ask me things, you know, I'd start to say what was the first thing on my mind, and I would stop and I would listen to that voice in my heart, and I would say the things that needed to be said for the first time in my life. And, you know, but then I would call my sponsor afterward and say, oh my God, my daughter just called and I told her this, and that's what I know I need to say, and that's what, you know, I believe, but it's not what I'm thinking. And she'd say, well, so you lied to your daughter. And I said, no, you told me to listen to my heart, and I listened to my heart. You're just trying to you need to teach me how to catch up with it, you know. And she'd hang up on me, and we go on. And, you know, and it was crazy that first few months. You know, I tried to do what she asked me to do, and she would give me assignments, and she would ask me to read stuff. And, you know, for a long time, I believed that I just kind of half-assed it, because I would do everything right before I met with her, like maybe 4 hours before, you know, on my lunch hour. And, you know, today I recognize I couldn't remember stuff. You know, I'd try to read this stuff, and it would be so beautiful, and I'd think of these things, and then I would close the book, and 4 hours later, I wouldn't remember it. So I would try to read it, like, 4 hours before I met with her, so I could, like, intelligently, you know, discuss this with her, because she, like, knew all this stuff, and I knew nothing. And I wanted to show her how smart I was, and how I was getting this program, because, you know, I just wanted her to tell me I was doing good, because I wanted to graduate AA and be fine. And, you know, she never did, no matter how hard I tried. And, you know, I didn't make it to a lot of meetings, not because I thought I was better, but I'm very socially awkward. I have a really, really hard time in a group of people. So it was really hard for me to go to meetings. She wanted me to get a service commitment. And so I did do a service commitment at the women's meeting for a while, and then she told me I was 6 months sober and I had to get another one. And so the amazing part about my story, I think, is, you know, I've told you how I couldn't go into Bridge Street Drunks and I couldn't go into the Alano Club at all. And on Thanksgiving of that year of 2013, I knew that I needed to go to a meeting on Thanksgiving morning, or I was probably going to cause a really big scene with my family. So I looked through the meeting list, and the only meeting that I could possibly make it to was Bridge Street Drunks. So I got myself together at 7 o'clock in the morning and drove from Tulare and walked into that meeting and sat down and felt at home. And I stayed for a very long time. The really cool thing was at Bridge Street Drunks is I went back. I was like, you know, this went really, really well, so I'm going to go back on Friday, too. So I went back on Friday, and they said to me, they said, so how long have you been sober? And I'm like, oh, almost 6 months. And they said, oh, good, we need a secretary for the Friday morning meeting, so why don't you do that? And I was like, oh, great, you know? And I was, like, so excited because finally somebody was recognizing how well I was doing, you know, and they wanted me to be the secretary, and that was the greatest thing in the whole entire world. And I showed up the next Friday morning, and there was like four people there, because Friday mornings they have a men's meeting. meeting, and all the men want to go over there. That's why they needed somebody else to be the secretary. So I was like, well, that didn't work out like I thought. But I had made a commitment, and the one thing that I wanted to be more than anything else was a person that showed up and that honored their commitment. So I went every Friday morning. There was a gentleman that did not leave, and he was there every Friday morning at 7 a.m., and he's still there every Friday morning at 7 a.m. And today I call him my angel because he was always there, and he always had something to say. And, you know, in the line of wanting to be really intelligent and being the secretary, I thought I should have something really extraordinary to say. And, you know, there'd be all these people that, you know, the four or five that would show up, they seemed to, like, know a lot about the book, and they could talk about it and discuss it, and I just couldn't because I couldn't remember. And so I'd read the daily reflections before I went and, you know, try to think of something super smart to say, you know, and I'd get there, and then it would be, like, totally different than what I had read, you know, because I was always forever reading the wrong day. And I was like, damn, you know. But the most amazing thing happened during that time frame. After about a couple months, you know, I was still trying to do what that sponsor said. I'd made it to the eighth step. And you know what? I was like, man, I have a lot of respect for those people that go in and out and, you know, have read this book before, because I was just reading what I had to keep up with my sponsor. I didn't read ahead, you know, that make a list of all the people you've harmed, and then they tell you, oh, yeah, well, you already did one. It was on your four-step list. And I'm like, well, shit, I'd have shortened that a lot, you know, if I would have known that. And so, you know, I really didn't like that eighth step at all. And by that point, I was getting really busy in life, and I wanted to change some things I was doing, and I knew my sponsor wouldn't like that. So, you know, being the brilliant alcoholic I am, I just decided to quit calling her. So I did. The only thing I did for the next 6 months is I went to that Friday morning meeting at Bridge Street drunk. It's the only thing I did. I worked really, really hard, and I didn't have a lot of free time, and I didn't drink, but I was completely miserable, absolutely positively miserable. And as I would go to that meeting on Friday mornings, I started noticing something that was in these people that I thought that I was better than when I first got here. And I realized that they had something I never had. They had hope. Hope for a change, hope for something different, hope for a better life. And I had no hope. And I thought, well, you know what? If they're getting it, I could get it. And I think I probably need to get a little bit back more into this program. And I think I probably need a different sponsor. So I went to that sponsor and told her thank you for what she had done. Because you know what? She helped me, and I wouldn't have stayed sober as long as I did if it hadn't been for her. But I was ready for something different. And she said, okay, and she wished me well. And then I was a little bit panicked because I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do now. You know, who's going to be my sponsor, and where am I going to find one, and how am I going to find one? And so I went back to the women's meeting, and this lady showed up there. And, you know, this lady, I had met her when I first got there. She was the one I didn't care for so much. In fact, I downright hated her. Everything she said, I hated. If she opened her mouth, I hated. And if she looked at me, I hated her worse. And every time I would run across her, I hated her again. And she showed up that night, and she was the one lady that after the meeting stood outside in the parking lot and talked to me for about 2 hours. And she said the most amazing thing to me. She said, you know, I really think this program is starting to work because you're actually starting to make sense. And I was like, oh my God, somebody understands me, you know? She should probably be my sponsor. So I invited her over to my house, and she came, and we started talking, and I kind of hemmed and hawed for a while. And she said to me, she says, well, did you want to ask me anything, or what's going on? I said, well, you know, I'd really like to ask you to be my sponsor. And she says, well, what is it you want out of sobriety? And I'm like, God, you know, she's been sober like 40 years, and she's asking me that. Well, obviously, I don't want to drink. How dumb is she? But I said, well, you know what? I don't want to drink. And she says, well, but what else do you want? And I said, oh, I don't want to drink, and I want a life. And she says, well, she says, you know, I don't really like the word sponsor. I kind of like mentor. So, you know, we can get together and we can talk about what's going on in your life and how you're going to apply these steps and how you're going to use them. And we could do that. And she said, but she looked at me and she said, but you have to be responsible for your own sobriety because I'm going to stay sober. And if you die, you die. And she got up and she walked out. And I was like, well, that is not exactly how it was supposed to happen. and you know, maybe I'm not going to call her either. So I didn't. And I spent the next few nights completely sleepless, which was what I was worried about the most when I quit drinking, is that I wouldn't be able to sleep. And here I was for the first time not being able to sleep, and I didn't know why. And about the fourth day, waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning and becoming really restless, I went, you know, maybe I should read the big book for myself. So I got the big book out and started reading. And once I got through the first 164 pages and started to see my story on every page of the big book, I called that sponsor again. And she says, well, you know, I was kind of wondering if maybe I was a little over the top when I told you if you died, you died. And I said, you told me if I died, I died? And she said, yeah. She said, you didn't hear that? I said, no. Actually, once you told me I had to be responsible, I kind of blanked out after that. That scared me to death. And so we started working together, and, you know, I still wasn't going to a lot of meetings, but I was meeting with her regularly. I was still doing my Friday morning commitment, and, you know, things were starting to change. And the one part of the big book that was very baffling to me was where it said, you had to let go of all of your old ideas, you know, and I thought, well, who would hold on to those, you know, because obviously that isn't very smart, and I'm smart, you know, and I thought that I had, you know, and it worked out really well for me because I didn't have any friends. I drank alone at the end, so, you know, I didn't have to give up my old friends. I didn't go anywhere because I was drunk all the time, so I didn't have to not go there, you know, so I couldn't figure out what that meant. And, you know, we continued to work together, and after about 6 months, you know, I was doing my normal stuff that I would do. I'd got rid of one him and got another him because we've always got to have somebody, you know, and that wasn't going quite like I thought it should go, and I was kind of dragging my hiney around and feeling sorry for myself again, and went out that morning in February right before my second birthday, and there was a letter taped on my steering wheel of my car, and my son that I had raised for 21 years that had a multi-medical condition. He'd been to San Francisco and had 35 surgeries. We go 8 times a year. I was a single parent. It was a huge amount of stuff to get him to the point that he was, that he was very functional and self-supporting. Wrote me a letter and told me that he thought he needed to be a girl and he was going to change his gender. And I was like, well, that problem that I got in the car with didn't seem quite so big anymore. And, you know, I was like, how am I going to fix this one? You know, what am I going to do? And, you know, I didn't really have the answer to that. And I was totally clueless. And all I could think was I need to go to a meeting. And I went to a meeting. And, you know, and of course I called my sponsor. And I kept going to meetings. And, you know, I just knew that I would find the answer. And then about that time, a couple months later, we had family members start dying. And family members were dying like every 6 weeks until 3 of them had passed. And, you know, we had this other issue going on and that going on, and I didn't have time to do anything or even think and, you know, just keep moving forward because the last thing I wanted to do was drink, and I just wanted to stay alive. And so I was going to my meeting, and I was meeting with my sponsor, and I just kept going, and I just kept going. And finally she said to me one day after we had sat and had our marathon talk for hours and hours, she said, you know, this is okay. She says, we could do this, because sometimes it takes a lot of tomato to make tomato paste. But she said, honey, you're going to wear me out. You have to get connected. And, you know, at that moment in time, I was so afraid of wearing her out, I started going to meetings like crazy. In fact, this is one of the first meetings I walked into, and I put on my brave face, and I walked in, and there was a lot of people in here, and I sat down right there next to Jim, and he looked at me, and he said, you can't sit there. And I'm like, I don't see your name on it. I'm sitting here. And he said, okay. And, you know, over the next year, we ended up forging a friendship, and, you know, I looked forward to Wednesday nights coming and talking to Jim and hearing how the program worked for him. And, you know, I took a service position at this meeting, and that guaranteed I would be here. I've come to find out that service positions protect me from me, because if I make a commitment, I'll be there. And if I don't have a commitment, then I might convince myself I don't need to go. And so I started going to other meetings, and all of a sudden I was at 8 meetings a week, and I had 4 service commitments, and I was at my sponsor's one day, and And she said, "So what's changed?" And I said, "What do you mean what's changed?" And she says, "Well, how many meetings did you go to this week?" And I said, "I went to 8. She says, "How many servants' commitments do you have?" And I said, 4. And she says, "Well, don't you still have a full-time job?" And I said, "Yeah." And she says, "Don't you still work 2 other jobs on the side?" I'm like, "Well, yeah." And she says, "Well, how did you have the time to go to all those meetings?" And I looked at her and I said, "Because I'm an alcoholic. What do you think?" You know? And I realized that the first time I had finally joined AA. And that was the most amazing thing. And that's when the miracle started happening. Because now, you know what? I'm about 2 years sober. I know I need to be here. I earned my seat here. But I didn't have a story. You know, I didn't go to jail. I didn't have a really tragic life. I grew up in a family that my mom worked for the church and my dad was a cop. We never wanted for anything. We had everything we needed. There was a lot of love in our home. You know, there was not a lot of alcohol. You know, there was no reason for me to be here. And I didn't have a story. And, you know, I wanted a story. And I was like, "Well, you know what? I just know I'm an alcoholic, so I'm going to keep going." And that's when the magic happened. On my 2nd birthday, we had plans, my sponsor and I, what we were going to do to celebrate and everything. And I woke up 2 days before my 2nd birthday with the stomach flu. Sicker than a dog. Puking my guts out, running to the bathroom. And I was like, "Wow, who knew this is what the stomach flu felt like?" You know what? I'd had the stomach flu about 30 times a year, and it never felt like that. And then I started noticing that my toilet was really dirty, too, as my head was in it. And I was like, "You know, I never had dirty toilets before." I was like, "Man, I must have been barfing a lot when I was drinking, because I made sure I had clean toilets. I'm sticking my head in it." You know, and I was like, "Wow, who knew?" You know, and then I started going to more meetings, and I would get called on to share, and the craziest stuff was happening. One meeting we were talking about, people and the loneliness you go through and wanting to commit suicide and some very devastating things that happen in this disease. And, you know, somebody called on me to share, and I said, "You know, I thought about killing myself many, many times, but I was too afraid to because I was afraid I'd mess it up. I messed up a one-night stand, and if you can't do a one-night stand right, pretty sure you can't kill yourself right." And I was like, "Holy cow, you know what? I just told 50 people that, you know?" And I was like, "The 5th step says you got to tell God, yourself, and one other human being, not the whole meeting, you know?" But I was like, "Wow, you know what? I never knew that I was going through life wanting to kill myself, and that I slowly was, you know?" And things just kept happening like that. And I started going to a book study up on the north side of Isaiah on Thursday nights, and there wasn't a lot of people there. And, you know, so I kept going, and I really liked that atmosphere because it was small, and so you'd hear a lot of dialect. And one day I was sitting there, and a bunch of men came in, and they were men I had never really seen before, and they were very loud and boisterous and very opinionated. And, you know, I was kind of quiet because I tend to, you know, talk like Minnie Mouse, and people don't take me serious, and so I just sat there. And I get done with the meeting, and this man walks up to me, and he wasn't a very big stature, but he had a really big voice, and he gets right in my face, and he says, "So you think you're an alcoholic?" And I was horrified that he would ask me that. You know, I was like, you know, there was a time all I needed was for somebody to say to me, "You think you're an alcoholic?" And I'd have gladly left, and I might be dead, you know. So I told him, I said, "Yes, you know what, I'm an alcoholic, and my story is on every page of the big book, and I earned my seat here." And he says, "Well, you know what, I don't think you really are an alcoholic, and I don't think you really read the big book, and, you know, because you would be working the steps, and you would be doing what needs to be done." And I said, "You know, I am working the steps, and I have a sponsor, and I haven't drank, and I need to be here." And he said, "You know," and I always wanted to be that kind of person that had that AA face, you know, like people that have been around the program a lot, you could tell them outrageous stuff, and they just stare and look at you. You know, and they have no expression, you know, and they just listen to what you're saying. And I wanted that face so bad. And, you know, at this moment when this man's talking to me, I'm like, I must have got this face because he doesn't know I want to kill him. And he keeps talking, you know, and I didn't know whether I should be happy or upset. And, you know, and then he said to me, he said, "You know what, I don't think it's really working in your life because people that are really working the program, you can see it on their face." And, you know, at that moment I was like, oh, you know what, he just needs to see it. And, you know, that's when I came to find out, if you're really working the program, and this is working in your life, and you've got that connection to a higher power, and you are sober, you're going to see it. You know what? You don't have to tell people you do it. You just know it when you see the people. You know, and this has been an amazing journey for me. You know, I'm very grateful that today I haven't drank for 5 years, but I also know that's a gift. It's not a given. Every day when I wake up, I only have today. And that's probably one of the things that saved my life in this program, because, you know, life gets pretty daunting at times. You know, I told you about my son, and, you know, that was a little stressing, and people dying, and I had some health issues I had to deal with, and all of those things I would have drank over. And, you know, instead of drinking, I went to a meeting and listened to other alcoholics, and, you know, they were always saying something that fit what I needed to hear at that time. And, you know, I was really stressing over my son one day, and I went to the 7 o'clock meeting at Bridge Street, and my angel was telling this story, and he was talking about a son that was always getting in trouble, and that they would go and the dad would bail him out, and the story goes on. And finally one day the father decided, you know what, he said, God, this is your son. I did my job. It's time for you to take him back and do what you got to do. And so when the police came again, the father said, that's not my son, that's God's son. And he didn't bail the son out. And then years later, the son came back and said, hi, Dad. And, you know, when I told that story, you know what, it just fit my needs with my son at that time, because I realized, you know what, I had been a good mother. I had done what my son needed, and I had met my obligations. And his journey is his journey. I don't understand it, but I love him unconditionally, and I always will. And that's my job. And, you know, I was like, oh, my God, it all makes sense. And I'm like, oh, this is what they talk about in the big book, you know, that spiritual awakening. You know, everything makes sense, and there's the bright light and that aha moment. And, you know, I wanted to laugh, and I wanted to cry, and I wanted to tell somebody, and I didn't know what to do because I thought everybody's going to think I'm crazy. So I went home and I called my sponsor, and I said, you know, I think I had a spiritual awakening. And she asked me about it, and we talked it through. And you know, we got to the end, and I said, you know, this is really cool, and I love how this program works, but I really don't think I want to do that spiritual awakening thing again. And she says, well, why is that? I said, you know what? That was way too many emotions, and I just don't want to go through that ever again. And she says, well, you know what? Just think about it like a spiritual orgasm. And I was like, oh, you know what? I would do that again, you know? That's what you got to love about your sponsors. You know what? They have a solution for everything. You know, right before my third birthday, you know, I was turning 50, and I was like, okay, you know what? This is going to be my year. I'm going to get everything together, and I'm going to be just fabulous at 50. You know, and my version of fabulous at 50 was my hair was going to be longer, my butt was going to be smaller, I was going to have it all going on, you know, and it would be great. Well, 50 rolled around, and none of that happened. And I said to my sponsor, I said, you know, I really like this program, but I'm kind of sad because I kind of thought I was going to be fabulous at 50. And she said, you don't think you have a fabulous life? And I stopped, and I thought about it, and I went, you know what? I do have a fabulous life. I have exactly what I ever wanted out of life. I get to go to bed at night and know that I did the best that I could do. I get up in the morning, and I look in the mirror, and I like the person I am. I know that I have a purpose in life, and I don't know what it is, but if I ask for help, God's going to provide the direction that I need. I know that I should have died a million times over, and I didn't, so I'm here for a reason. That is pretty fabulous, you know? I was like, wow, you know what? It is fabulous. And, you know, I came to realize, I said, you know, if you're going to judge me by the size of my ass, you probably don't need to hang around me very long, because, you know what? We're not going to like each other. The value that I bring to the world is what's in my heart, because that's where my higher power lives, and that's the message that I have to share. And I said, you know, so life is pretty fabulous. So I said, I'm going to probably have to get a little busy, or my butt's going to be hanging around my knees here pretty soon. And, you know, the next day she sent me a message on Facebook, and you could buy a butt bra for $19.99 for two. You know, and I was like, yeah, them sponsors do have an answer for everything. So, you know, the story I have to tell you all today is I'm a hopeless, helpless alcoholic. I drank drink incessantly. I should be dead, and I'm not, by the grace of God. And today I don't have to pick up a drink as long as I keep that spiritual connection. If I practice these principles in all my affairs to the best of my ability, I am actually a nice person to be around, and I do have a message to share, and I love all of you, and I'm glad to be here. You know, if I don't practice the principles, even though I don't drink, I can still be a mean, hateful, ugly person, and that is very frightening to me. And sometimes I have to dabble in it a little bit just to remind myself why I like that spiritual connection. But it's pretty awesome that at any time I could stop and I can realize. And when it gets really difficult, I stop and think about it. You know, it's like, if this is my last day on earth, this is the only day I have, how do I want to live it? You know what? I want to live it with a smile on my heart and joy in my heart. A smile on my face and joy in my heart. And, you know, today I come to meetings, and I come to meetings often because I become very delusional very quickly. And when I come to meetings and hear other people's stories, I get to find my truths, recognize my gut, and see the possibilities that's showing in all of your faces. You know, today I can tell you that I don't ever walk alone. All I have to do at any given time is stop, close my eyes, and I can feel the hand of God on my shoulder at all times. And if I'm still a little bit troubled, all I have to do is walk into an AA meeting and I see a friend, and that's an awesome feeling. I'm going to close with this. When I went to Illinois, I went to meetings in other towns where I knew nobody for the first time in my life, and was going to the Alano Club, and they did the coolest thing at the end of the meeting. You know, we all hold hands, and I never knew what that was about, but I was kind of like that moment of being connected with all of you in the room. And in Illinois, they talk about it, and they say when they hold hands, they say, from this moment on, you'll no longer be alone, and hold tight to the hand of the person next to you, because it could be the person that saved your life. So thank you for being here for me and helping me be sober, and I'll always be here for you.